From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we will announce the Great Michigan Read for 2015-2016.
I see it as also a kind of love letter to our current world, this extraordinary world in which we find ourselves with the telephones, the airplanes, the running water, these miraculous things that we take for granted.
Why Mayor Duggan's focus on entrepreneurs is hitting all the right notes.
I know a lot of people talk about a comeback of Detroit. It's not a comeback. What we're witnessing, in my opinion, is more of an evolution. It's Detroit 2.0 or 3.0.
Why Michigan bluegrass favorites Lindsay Lou and the Flatbellies are Nashville bound.
So sometimes you have to leave what you love in order to see it from another vantage point and fall in love with it all over again.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly delivered the Snyder administration's proposed budget on transportation. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we talk with Kelly about money for our crumbling roads. And we announce the Michigan Humanities Council's Great Michigan Read. But first, Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan delivered his State of the City address this week. And it was noteworthy for some big reasons, according to Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, there really was this theme in the speech about not relying on what Detroit has for so long, the big three, industry, but instead new businesses, entrepreneurs.
Yeah, you know, he never really talked about the autos and the big players, so to speak. What struck me was just how he focused on the basics of blocking and tackling entrepreneurship, how to support businesses, how to give people opportunities so that they can get jobs. I thought the money quote in the whole thing was when he said near the end, I'm not talking about giving anyone anything. You want the jobs, you have to work for them. You want the investment, you're going to have to compete for it. And I thought, boy, I haven't heard that from a Detroit mayor in a long time. And I think that's a very interesting approach, and it may be charting the path for Detroit going forward. I know a lot of people talk about a comeback of Detroit. It's not a comeback. What we're witnessing, in my opinion, is more of an evolution. It's Detroit 2.0 or 3.0. It's going to be different than the Detroit a lot of people knew in the past.
And as you say, it's so different from what we've seen from previous administrations. So he's really charting this new course that takes us back to Detroit's roots.
Yeah, I think a lot of people forget, unless they're really historically minded, that both Detroit and Michigan's roots were planted by entrepreneurs. And really the Michigan that a lot of people knew and think back on, the golden age, if you will, was the fruit of that entrepreneurial spirit. And that morphed into big company, big labor, big everything that became so unwieldy and ultimately was not able to compete or deal with the world as it was. And so as a result, we've gone through the largest both public sector and private sector bankruptcies in American history right here.
And as you write, this is different. This is like a city, in your words, preparing for its next act. But of course, there are things that could stand in the way of all of this, no?
Well, sure. I mean, starting with people and their behavior. I mean, I think what's also remarkable about the mayor's approach here, you know, if you watched the State of the City, number one, city council was sitting on the stage with him, which is unusual. He walked by and shook every hand and then talked about every member, very much trying to convey that this is a team, that these people are working together. So I think that's one thing. I think the other thing, obviously, is the macroeconomic environment. You've got companies that are doing very well, auto companies that are making a lot of money, a lot of other businesses that are investing in Detroit and in their businesses. That's all to the good for the city. And finally, they have to manage a budget that's very tight and will continue to be tight, and they're going to have to do that for at least the next 3 years.
Daniel Howes, Detroit News business columnist, who joins us every Thursday here on Stateside. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Experimentation.
Curiosity.
The next idea.
Technology alone is not enough.
Does putting an iPad into the hands of school kids improve education? There is a widely held sense that Incorporating technology and software into the classroom experience will help improve student performance. But our next idea partner, Jeff DeGraff, says beware of leaning too heavily on technology to reform education. Jeff is a clinical professor of management and organizations at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. Jeff, what are some of the big technological innovations in education, specifically for the classroom, that you've seen in the last few years?
Well, there's really three of them. The big one is flipping the classroom, and this really comes from what are called MOOCs, Massive Open Online Courses. And so this is like the Khan Academy, and in higher ed, it's like Coursera. And the object of those courses and the uses of technology in those courses is that it's delivered when people are riding on the subway or working out, and then you use the classroom to actually do your homework. The second big one, of course, is handheld technology. And what that does for you is it takes you away from the computer. It allows you to take that tablet into the field. It allows you to get information in real time. But, of course, the biggest one, I think, is the connectivity that works horizontally. And what I mean by that is it used to be that the person at the front of the classroom was the expert and the person who was in the back of the classroom was the novice. And now what's happening is because of the horizontal nature or the connected nature of these tablets and the ubiquitous nature of smartphones and this technology, people are sharing information with each other on a regular basis. So it changes how content is developed. And think about a great example of this is Wikipedia. It used to be the Encyclopedia Britannica was done by experts at the University of Michigan and places around the world. Now it's people are creating their own content. So those are kind of the three big trends.
So there are great things out there, but you're arguing in your essay there are definitely limitations to technology in the classroom. And you experienced that when you were working with a school district. What happened?
Well, this is going back a ways. I worked with one of the largest school districts in the United States, and the issue was improving literacy. So what we did was we did a lot of studies on who could read and who couldn't read. And it turned out that about one-third of this very large metropolitan area, the children were functionally illiterate. So what we tried to do was to introduce technologies that we thought would help them learn. So for example, this is back in the day of laser discs. We introduced a laser disc where we actually taught young people how to drive because that was something young people are very motivated. So computer-based training, learning how to drive. What we discovered at the end of this very long, very arduous, very expensive experiments is they learned how to drive. They didn't learn how to read. And it reminded me of something that I read years ago. One of my distant relatives is a man named Charles Fair de Graaf. And what he was very famous for, in fact, Life magazine at the turn of the last century said he was one of the most 100 most important people of the century. He was the man who created pocketbooks and famous for the creation of paperback books. And his view was that once books became very cheap, remember they were a nickel. Mm-hmm. Once books became cheap and you could buy them at the bus station, everybody would become literate. And in fact, they didn't. And it's the same thing over and over and over again. We confuse two things. We confuse why something happens with how something happens. So technology is how something can happen, and it's very good. I want to be a big supporter, mm-hmm. but it's not why people learn.
And in your essay for the next idea, you recommend use technology as a means to reach something else. And I love the phrase you use, fall in love with the problem, not the solution. What do you mean by that?
Well, every second there's a new technology that's coming out. I mean, this is the world I live in. And what happens is people, they say, well, the answer to everything's going to be the tablet. And of course, we had this great controversy less than a year ago in Los Angeles, where they spent almost $1.5 billion to give everybody in the greater Los Angeles school district a tablet. And of course, it didn't work. And what the scandal was the kids were hacking the tablets and using it for things that were inappropriate. But that wasn't the real problem. The real problem was it wasn't integrated into the curriculum in any way. They didn't change the teacher at the front of the room and the student at the back of the room. They didn't change the I'm smarter than you paradigm. They didn't change kids sharing information, but nobody really being the expert. I mean, think about it. You got online with all your social media. It'd be great if you said, what's a great rock band? But if you said, how do you do a root canal? It would be a disaster. Mm. So you have to have domain expertise. So they didn't change anything about how pedagogy or the methodology worked. They didn't change anything about the curriculum. So it was doomed to fail.
They treated it like a little flat textbook.
They treated it like it was electronic Velcro.
Now, you recommend recruiting the early adapters to test out new ideas and technology and reward them too, right?
Yes. If your house is anything like mine, there's a lot of young people in my house who are really technologically fluent. Mm-hmm. And they can do all kinds of things. And now remember, I'm trained as a technologist. Yeah. My doctorate's in this area. But they're doing stuff that I never imagined, even with some technologies that I helped develop, right? So the first thing is watch them. Pay attention like an ethnographer would, how they're using the technology, and then enroll them. How might I teach this subject with the way that you use the technology instead of trying to fight the way they use it or impose this kind of boomer mentality on them?
Although, isn't there an age issue there? I mean, if I'm handing out iPads to third graders, am I going to ask them how to teach the content?
Well, to some degree, yes. It's a curious thing. I think from a very early age, this kind of horizontal view of the world and technological literacy starts very early with our children. So yes, of course, there's an issue of who do you really listen to? Yeah. And there are always early adapters and better or worse adapters in any group of people. But I don't see any harm in paying attention to or the innovative idea of giving some technology to some people, saying here's some problems we're trying to solve. How would you solve them? And paying close attention to how they do it.
So moving forward, how do you think school districts should approach new technologies? Because they have a lot to choose from. They have limited resources. What should they consider when they're deciding what they're going to go with?
I think the first question is, what do you really want to achieve with the curriculum? And I think the second question is much harder. What are you willing to give up in the classroom to use these technologies effectively? And if the whole idea is that you're not willing to change the role of the teacher standing in the front of the room and delivering the lesson, the technology is probably not very valuable to you. The technology becomes more valuable when the teacher at the front of the room is maybe helping you actually work through the problem, so they become an expert practitioner. Maybe when they help you by becoming a domain expert, meaning when everyone's sharing information but it's maybe inaccurate, when that teacher is actually encouraging students in the classroom, maybe in varying levels, to work with each other in order to change those levels or maybe varying styles. When the teacher actually becomes part of the customization process, then I think it becomes very valuable. If it's the old style model, right, I don't think it's going to help them one jot.
You can find Jeff DeGraff's essay on technology in schools at the Next Idea link at michiganradio.org. Share your thoughts in the comments section under his essay or go to Michigan Radio's Facebook page or on Twitter at Next Idea MI. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Coming up next, cue the drum roll. Stateside will be the first to announce the Michigan Humanities Council's latest choice for the Great Michigan Read. Then Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly will be with us to talk budget shortfall and road money. That's in 20 minutes.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One title, one state, and thousands of readers getting caught up in literary discussion. That's the Great Michigan Read. It's a biennial program of the Michigan Humanities Council. And it is my pleasure to make the announcement of the Great Michigan Read for 2015-2016, Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. This was a 2014 National Book Award finalist. It was on the top 10 books of the year list from the Washington Post, Time Magazine, Amazon, and many other accolades. Emily St. John Mandel, so good to have you here with us.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
I gobbled up this story, and after I finished it, I was trying to decide if I could label it post-apocalyptic. Well, yeah, because most of civilization's been wiped out by a ferocious flu, but a morality play or a tribute to culture and arts and humanities. How do you think of Station 11?
You know, you could almost go with all of the above from that list. When I'm asked to describe Station 11 very briefly, what I usually go with is it's about a traveling Shakespearean theater company in a post-apocalyptic North America. Which, in fact, it's a post-apocalyptic Michigan.
Which, it is.
Yeah, which is why I was so thrilled and honored and happy to have the book be chosen as the pick this year. But the book's about a lot more than that. You know, of course, it's set about half of it set in the present day. The other half set approximately 20 years after a flu pandemic has changed the world as we know it. And in that post-apocalyptic future, a traveling Shakespearean theater company and orchestra moves between the settlements of the altered world. I think of the book in a very broad sense as being about what remains. What are we left with when all of the details and the apparatus of civilization, if those are stripped away, what do we have left? Now, we have culture, we have family, we have our relationships with other people. That was really what I was trying to explore in this book. And I see it as also a kind of love letter to our current world, this extraordinary world in which we find ourselves with the telephones, the airplanes, the running water, these miraculous things that we take for granted.
And I love the way you have the characters in the post-pandemic world, the ones who are old enough to remember and think about what it was like to be able to open a tap or flip
right,
on a light
right.
or looking at the iPhone that has been put into a museum that's mm-hmm. created because let's keep these artifacts. It's so easy to nitpick today's world and criticize, but you realize if that was gone, what would be lost?
Absolutely. What would be lost? And it makes you think about what we have. The comedian Louis C.K. had a wonderful riff about cell phones. He said, you know, we complain about our cell phones. Oh, this thing's working so slowly. He said, you know, it's going to space. You know, give it a moment. And that's the kind of thing that we completely take for granted, that we can just pick up a device and call people.
You show us so skillfully how society collapses and in no time at all what we think of as modern life is in ruins. Was that difficult for you to imagine and create for the page?
I would say it was unsettling to imagine and create for the page. You know, you like to think that you don't take things for granted and that you appreciate everything you have. But when you start thinking about what the world looks like when those things are stripped away, imagining what life would be like with no electricity or no running water, and how much of your day would be caught up and committed to just the tedious details of survival, you know, gathering food, water, dealing with shelter, etc. So it was profoundly unsettling and also probably a good exercise. It does force you to look at this world that surrounds us and recognize how delicate it is and perhaps appreciate it a little bit more.
Emily, what was the very first germ of the idea you had that kicked off this whole thing that blossomed into Station 11?
It's a great question. The first germ of an idea was I wanted to write about the life of an actor. So I've written three previous novels, and they were all generally categorized as literary noir, which is a genre that I love. But I knew if I kept going in that direction, I'd eventually be pigeonholed as a crime writer. And I love crime fiction and have huge respect for crime writers, but who wants to be pigeonholed as anything?
So
I thought for my fourth novel, it would be interesting to do something completely different. And around that time, I was reading a really interesting book. It was an oral history of the Public Theater in New York, which is just a wonderful institution that started off with these fantastic, free, sort of guerrilla performances of Shakespeare in Central Park in the 60s and 70s, when Central Park was pretty scary and it was a very different city. So I was reading this book, these anecdotes of people who had been involved in the theater over the years, and one of them had just a throwaway story about, oh, do you remember that time that actor died of a heart attack in the fourth act of King Lear? As a novelist, you see something like that and you just think, that's an opener. I've got to use that. So I started with that. And at the same time, I did want to write about the modern world. The awe that I feel, I don't think that's too strong a word, at this extraordinary apparatus of civilization that surrounds us. And of course, one way to write about something is to write about its absence. So it was interesting to begin to think of it as a post-apocalyptic narrative, as a way of writing about these modern times. And those two threads just kind of came together. When I say just came together, I mean I spent 2 years revising it. It's a bit of a marathon.
It is. Yeah. Well, it is. And you take us back and forth in
right,
time. And there
right.
are so many character stories who I think kind of come together, the linchpin or kind of, I think, probably the center of the Venn diagram
right.
of all this is this actor, Arthur Leander.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It, as we've been saying, Station 11 takes us back to the start of this pandemic and then up to the present where this group of actors and musicians, the Traveling Symphony, are moving through the wilderness of Michigan from mm-hmm. town to town along the shores of Lake Huron and Michigan. Why set the book in Michigan?
I had no connection whatsoever to the state. And then I came here on book tour in 2010 for my second novel, The Singer's Gun. It was a wonderful tour. I went to Traverse City for the first time and Petoskey, and I just really fell in love with that whole area along the lakeshore. So I'd been thinking for a while about setting something here. And then, of course, if you have a post-apocalyptic narrative, you want access to fresh water. So it suddenly made a lot of sense to put it here. For narrative reasons, I needed a territory that one could plausibly have walked to from Toronto. And it's, you know, it's a bit of a hike, but it's, you know, same general section of the continent. So, yeah, it was really those things. I really like that Michigan Lakeshore area. And, yeah, I thought it would be fun to set something there.
Would you read us an excerpt from Station 11? And this is when one of the key characters, Kirsten, and one of her symphony castmates, August, they're foraging for supplies after they've gotten separated from the traveling symphony, and they come upon a house.
Absolutely. They hadn't come across an untouched house in years. Upstairs, there was a room that had once belonged to a child. The child in question was still present, a husk in the bed. Kirsten pulled a quilt over its head while August was still going through the downstairs bathroom. And there was a framed photograph on the wall of a boy with his parents. The boy in a Little League uniform, with his parents kneeling on either side. She heard August's footsteps behind her. "Look what I found," he said. He'd found a metal Starship Enterprise. The boy had loved both baseball and space. "We should keep moving," Kirsten said after a moment. August's gaze had fallen to the bed. She left the room first so he could say one of his prayers, although she wasn't actually sure if prayer was the right word for it. When he murmured over the dead, he seemed to be talking only to them. "I hope it was peaceful at the end," she'd heard him say. Or, "You have a really nice house. I'm sorry for taking your boots." Or, "Wherever you are, I hope your family's there too." To the child in the bed, he spoke so quietly that Kirsten couldn't hear. The only words she caught were "up in the stars," and she moved quickly on to the master bedroom so that he wouldn't catch her eavesdropping. But she saw that August had been there already. The boy's parents had died in their bed, and a cloud of dust hung in the air above them from when August had pulled out the blankets to cover their faces.
That's Emily St. John Mandel reading from her novel Station 11, just named as the 2015-2016 Great Michigan Read by the Michigan Humanities Council. And one of the reasons that this book was chosen, Station 11, for the entire state to read in coming months is because your story focuses on how important culture and arts and the humanities are in preserving what keeps us human. Will you talk some more about that?
Absolutely, absolutely. So as the symphony moves from town to town in this book, they have a motto that's been painted on the lead caravan, and that motto is "survival is insufficient." And in the interest of full disclosure, I did steal that quote from Star Trek Voyager. I would have stolen it from anywhere. It was just when I heard that quote on a TV show in the late 90s, it just struck me as the most elegant and succinct encapsulation of something that I believe to be true. And it really functions as the thesis statement of this book, which is that survival isn't enough. It's never enough for us. And you don't have to go into a post-apocalyptic future to see that. You know, you see it in the present day that, you know, you read the news. We play musical instruments in refugee camps. We put on plays in war zones. There was a fashion show in Paris when the city was still reeling from the Second World War. So we seem to have this instinct toward art or toward some kind of grace, I guess you could say, in a very secular way in this case. Survival's never enough for us. And that was something that I was really interested in exploring in this book, that one of the things that would remain, I think, would be our culture or some remnants of our culture.
You know, it's something actually, as I was reading your book, and to think about the fact that Michigan is emerging from what's called the Great Recession, where our economy and cities and people coped with some very, very challenging and uncertain times. But, you know, as your story, the artists and the writers and the innovators kept at it and kept moving forward.
Right. It's important. I think there's something in art that reminds us about what it means to be human and that it reminds us of civilization.
I have to wonder, when were you actually writing this novel?
I want to say I started it in December 2011, more or less.
It's just interesting because I think, and here we have the nation worrying about Ebola and a flu vaccine right. that according to the CDC right. is only 23% effective this year across all age groups, and the measles outbreak. Synchronous timing, I guess.
It is. It is and it isn't. Is what you come to realize if you start researching pandemics, which I did a little bit in the context of this book, is that there was always going to be another Ebola. There was always going to be another measles. There will be something after this and something after what follows. The history of humanity is in many ways a history of pandemics. And, you know, it's interesting. I find myself thinking about some of the stories I read in my pandemic research, and some of them are quite haunting. There's one in particular I find myself thinking about, perhaps because it's from the region where I grew up in Western Canada. But it's the end of the 18th century. Captain George Vancouver and his crew are sailing north up the west coast of the land that will later become Canada. And as they travel northward, they find themselves increasingly unsettled. Because here they are in this lovely temperate climate, this incredibly fertile landscape, but it's strangely empty. They go ashore and find native villages that could house hundreds of people, but they've been abandoned. And they begin to find skeletons on the beach because smallpox has already come through. So you read something like that, and it makes you realize that writing a book in which a fictional pandemic takes out civilization is really an exaggeration of a non-fictional premise. And that's obviously incredibly dark, but on the other hand, as a species, we have survived. We're still here after smallpox, the flu, the bubonic plague, everything else that's hit us over the millennia. So there is a certain fatalistic hope, I suppose, if that's not a complete contradiction in terms. And doing this research, and yeah, it does make me feel that it makes me feel some optimism, believe it or not.
Well, I have to tell you, as I read the book, I found the Alexander Pope line running through my head, hope springs eternal in the human breast.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
It really did. The Great Michigan Read Program will create reader's guides, teacher's guides, bookmarks, and other materials, and they're free for anyone who wants to become a part of the program. And we should also note high schools, libraries, and certain nonprofits will be eligible for free copies of Station 11. And Emily will be making four tours in Michigan throughout 2015 and 2016. You can get all the details at michiganhumanities.org. Emily St. John Mandel, it was incredible to read your writing and such a pleasure to get to visit with you here on Stateside. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When artists listen to the heart, they're usually looking for emotion or inspiration. No stethoscope needed until now. Thanks to some pretty sophisticated medical equipment, Interlochen Arts Academy students have been jamming to the beats of their own hearts. Next week, they're putting on a show that blends the traditional artist's notion of heartache with a physical representation of their healthy teenage hearts. Interlochen Public Radio's Linda Steffen reports.
Mr. I'm Too Good.
17-year-old singer-songwriter Juliana Schemel. When she hits the stage, her heart races.
Oh my gosh, it beats out of my chest. When I was littler, it was more like shaking, and you know, it still gets me every time I have to go up there because it's like, oh gosh, everybody's watching you, everybody's looking to see what you're going to do, what the next movie you're going to make, you know. So yeah, my heart beats out of my chest completely.
Generally, musicians like Juliana are taught to ignore that natural metronome pounding in the chest so they can stay on beat with the music. But what if the heart were the metronome?
What we wanted to do was to see how different sounds coming from the heart could function as a musical instrument.
This is cardiologist Brian Jaffe. He recently took some healthy Interlochen jazz musicians to Munson Medical Center in Traverse City. He dressed them in hospital gowns and he hooked them up to an EKG machine. The machine interprets the blood flow and translates it to sound, not the beeps that you typically think of with a heart monitor, but something lower frequency and more fluid. And then the students were told to improvise.
And it was really cool because we were following the blood flow in this one young man's heart. And when he got more excited, his heartbeat sped up and the blood flow increased and the other guys just followed along.
And there was this moment where the heartbeat of the person that was being connected to the echo machine and Solomon playing the double bass on top of it, it felt like they were just uniting. And we all felt it in the room, but of course we couldn't explain it.
For comparative arts instructor Nikki Conraths, it's the part that can't be explained that is most interesting, as her students look at the connection between the physical body and the soul of their artwork. Haley Jennings is one of her students, a senior at the Interlochen Arts Academy. She was struck by the differences found in each student's heartbeat.
And how maybe one would have a little bit more, ba-boom, 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 and it would have like more personality and like spunk, and it'd be like, oh, it goes perfect for that personality of the person. It was really, really interesting. You wouldn't expect, you know, from an organ that's there, you know, specifically for a purpose, but...
Do you remember what yours sounded like?
I don't know. I got really nervous, which is ironic because, like, obviously there's nothing wrong with me, but just the whole medical experience, I'm like, oh, what's going to happen? But, yeah, I think mine was just kind of like, and I'm like, okay, so I have a hiccup in my heart.
What I may see or hear in the course of the treatment, smoking.
No! Do you have insurance?
No! Do you have insurance? I just want to go home.
A multimedia show next week features this performance. It's called The Bad News Jam. There will also be a live jazz improv featuring Hart as the EKG makes a rare appearance outside the hospital. And live concert goers will even have the chance to look at some of the students' heartbeats, translated from sound to image and silkscreened in vivid color.
That was Interlochen Public Radio's Linda Steffen reporting Heart and Art is live at Interlochen's Phoenix Theater next week. The show will be webcast Friday, February 20th. Still to come, Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly will join us, and then as our series Living with Death continues, we'll see why we must grieve when someone we love dies. That's in 10 minutes on Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Earlier this week, Governor Snyder delivered his proposed budget for the next fiscal year. At his side was Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly, who joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. Great to be on your show.
You presented the transportation part of the administration's budget yesterday, and there were a lot who noted afterwards there wasn't much of a backup plan if voters say no to that ballot proposal in May that would increase transportation funding. Why was that?
Essentially what the backup plan is the status quo, which is completely unacceptable to most people across the state. The ballot initiative is the permanent ongoing solution to our crumbling infrastructure. And so we do need all hands on deck and for there to be a substantial effort to make sure that people understand that this is our shot to get it fixed. We have increasingly dangerous and expensive conditions in our roadways, and the most expensive option is our status quo. We really do need to get this fixed. So in terms of the budget, of course, we did the budget according to current law. We don't project that anything is going to happen in the future in terms of the way that we construct our budget. But, of course, before this budget is completed, that May vote will take place. And we do expect an affirmative response. And at that point, we will be on our way to having a much smoother and safer future for Michigan infrastructure.
I think for many who hear the words state comeback or economic recovery, I think people were surprised to learn last month the state is facing a relatively large budget shortfall, $800 million for the next 2 years, happening because businesses are coming to Lansing and redeeming tax breaks that they were promised during the Great Recession. How is it the administration wasn't more aware that this was going to happen sooner or later and that the state was going to have to pay up?
We had been budgeting for a very significant utilization of the Granholm era tax credits all along. And the size and the scope of those tax credits are very much dependent on how many jobs are created by these particular companies that held the tax credits. The surprise, I guess, if there was one to talk about, is just the companies and the amount of employees that they hired was substantially more than what was projected just a few years ago. And those employees have been hired at higher wages than were projected a few years ago. So that's the silver lining on the budget dark cloud that we have to deal with now, is that the credits are so big because that many more people have been hired and been hired at higher wages.
Democrats were quick to jump on the budget yesterday, saying that it didn't do enough to put money back in education. We need to note the budget does increase per pupil funding by $75. That's 1%. Is that enough in your mind?
That is just one item of education, and ignores a very substantial additional investments in education in a lot of different ways. For example, in skilled trades education, we are looking at a 75% increase. We believe that the state that leads in skilled trades will be the state that leads, whose economy leads the nation, and that's why we want to be number one, literally number one in skilled trades. We also launched an initiative to provide resources for third grade reading, and another significant effort there. And then on top of that, the amount of money that we have put into the retirement, paying the retirement obligations for schools and making the reforms that we did, has saved local schools $1,075 per student. And that's other, if we hadn't done what we did, that's how much more their expenses would be today. And so it's easy for, I understand Democrats, that's their job to attack. But the thing is that education is a clear priority, a big winner in this budget. And it's one that we're proud of the record of supporting education over the course of the last 4 years, but particularly proud that in a time when we have some challenges overall with our revenues, that we've still found a way to provide additional strategic support to education, making sure that our people have the skills that they need to compete in a 21st century economy.
Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly speaking about the administration's budget proposal for the upcoming fiscal year. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
The way we mourn the deaths of our loved ones has a lot to do with the culture we come from. And one woman from Mount Clemens has become an expert in studying how people from different cultures and eras mourn their dead.
I have some friends that call me the death lady. I don't know if I really like that.
But there are some very personal and difficult reasons Kim Parr is drawn to this kind of work. As our series Living with Death continues, Michigan Radio's Kyle Norris explains.
Kim Parr puts on historical events like a cemetery walk at St. Peter Cemetery. That's where actors portray the people who were buried there, including a priest who came here from Belgium and died in 1902. The actors give monologues, and they really get into it.
Hi.
Good day.
Good day. How are you?
I'm well. How are you, my child?
Good, good. I'm a reporter at Michigan Radio, so I'm going to get a little sound of what you're doing.
Absolutely. And what is radio?
It's in the future.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Many things are in the future. Well, good day, everyone. So nice.
Kim Parr directs the Macomb County Historical Society and the Crocker House Museum in Mount Clemens. She travels around the state lecturing about funeral customs and the ways that we used to mourn our dead. But there was a time when Parr knew very little about grief and death. When she was 16, Parr's father died suddenly of an aneurysm.
We were not prepared for it. Four kids at home. My mom was about my age. I'm 47. And how she dealt with having four kids at home, and really she didn't have time to mourn. Here I was, 16, helping to pick out a casket, helping, you know, with the funeral details.
Later in her life, her best friend was killed. She says both of those deaths were very, very hard to deal with.
I know when my father died, I was just 16. I think for a year, I felt like I was in the Twilight Zone. It was just so shocking. Your whole world has changed. But everybody's still going on and doing the same things. And you just kind of want to say, stop. Stop. This isn't fair. But that's life. We go on.
Part of what Parr loves about the Victorian era is that the community knew how to respond and how to help when someone died. There were rules about the kind of clothes that you wore and how long to mourn. Sometimes that took years. These days, Parr thinks that we rush through mourning. When we mourn, we are grieving the loss of attachments we've made in our lives. That's what clinical social worker Sally Foley says. And that idea of just getting over it does not serve us well.
all of life is loss. We don't want to get over life too fast. We want to learn to live with life, and that includes living with loss.
She says the thing about mourning is you've got to do it. And when we grieve, we take the love we had for that person, and we find ways to remember them inside ourselves.
And as we grow developmentally, whether we're 10 or 28 or 88, at each developmental age, we're going to go back and revisit that loss in a new context and a new understanding of who we are now.
She also says mourning needs two big things, community recognition and community support. And the Victorians had this part down. But when that community support and recognition is not there, think of the AIDS epidemic in the 80s. Or when someone doesn't take time to mourn, they can get stuck or suppressed and end up closing down. Some days, Kim Farr says she does not feel like teaching people about death and grief and mourning and funerals. But she says this kind of work won't quite let her go.
And then I think, well, maybe I'm not supposed to let this go. If I'm helping people look at death in a way that it's okay, it's just what we all have to go through, and it's okay to talk about it and to get our children to talk about it, then I think I'm doing something good.
Kim Parr says she has grappled for years with guilt about her best friend's death and her father's death. In fact, it's been decades, and she is still processing those very big losses in her life. For Stateside, I'm Kyle Norris.
And you can find all the stories in our Living with Death series. Just go to michiganradio.org and click the link that says Stateside. Lindsay Lou and the Flatbellies are releasing a new album on Saturday. It's called Ionia, which is the small Michigan town where this album was recorded. Stateside's Emily Fox has been covering the latest music coming out of Michigan this month. She has more.
This album by Lindsay Lou and the Flatbellies was recorded in the dining room of the home Lindsay Lou and her husband, who also happens to be the mandolin player in the band, were living in at the time. But Lindsay Lou and the Flatbellies have left Ionia and Michigan and moved to Nashville. I am now joined by Lindsay Lou. And Lindsay, why did you guys decide to leave?
We've been talking about it for a long time. The original Flatbelly banjo player moved there after he graduated college, and he would call us and tell us these magical fairy tales of jamming with our heroes in living rooms, and just the community of young people, of people who are just like us, who just want to get together and learn songs and jam and sort of feed off of each other's energy and experiences. And it's all happening there, and it's in Michigan, and it's a little bit spread out, you know. We've got friends and peers in Traverse City and in Ann Arbor and in Grand Rapids and in Lansing and in the UP. And when we're here and we're bouncing around, we get to have these experiences. But it'll be nice to have it in one neighborhood. And also, we're just looking to get out and explore a little bit. Some of us have in the band have never lived anywhere but Michigan. And so to get out, and the one experience I have living elsewhere was when I lived in Ecuador for 5 months. And it really made me love and appreciate Michigan in a whole new way. So sometimes you have to leave what you love in order to see it from another vantage point and fall in love with it all over again.
I'm speaking with Lindsay Lou of Lindsay Lou and the Flatbellies. Their latest album, Ionia, will be released Saturday. Let's listen to another track on this album. This is called Smooth and Groovy.
And just to keep things on smooth and groovy, when your world won't stop moving, and when your flame it ceases burning, just to keep things on smooth and groovy, as I keep things on. Keep things on the smooth.
say, wow. I mean, when you are on stage, all eyes are on you. I mean, you dance as if no one's looking. When you sing, you have so much character in your voice and you really let it out. How did you get to the point when you were on stage that you feel so comfortable and you let your voice shine and with, I guess, just being vulnerable while you're there?
I might have been born with it. My mom told me this story about when I was 3 years old. We were at this big gathering. It was my great-grandpa's birthday. And I sort of remember this. I didn't know any of these people. You're a three-year-old kid. And I walked up to my mom and I pulled on her dress and I told her that I wanted to get on stage and sing happy birthday for Grandpa. And I did. I got up in front of, I don't know, maybe there was 100 people there and sang happy birthday to the audience.
You're like, I'm going to sing, like, and you're going to like it.
Yeah. And I mean, when you're that young, you're not thinking about why you're doing it. It's just there. It's in there.
But it's amazing that you're still being able to keep that youthfulness that, you know, as kids, they let it all out. They don't have to think about what other people think about them or that other people may be analyzing them. So to be able to keep that childlike nature and then still let that talent grow along the way that's pretty nice to have.
Thanks.
So you write most of the songs for Lindsay Lou and the Flat Bellies. And it seems that there aren't a lot of women, as you know, in comparison to men, that write their own songs. You're also on stage playing guitar and banjo, you're accompanying yourself. So the combination of writing most of the music for the band as well as being on stage, playing an instrument, accompanying yourself, I don't feel like there are as many women as men doing something like that. Why do you think that is?
I think that there are as many women as men doing it, but less women putting themselves out there to do it in the public eye. Almost always, when I'm on the road and when I'm finding myself in musical situations, I look around and a lot of the times I'm the only woman there. It's not the case all the time, but there is a trend. I'm reading this book called The Confidence Code, and there are a lot of studies in there that struck me with information that it makes sense, but I would have never guessed these things.
Like what?
Like that if women are reminded of their gender before they take an exam about math and science, they perform less well. That's some deep stuff. That it's beyond spelling women with a Y, you know? It's so deeply ingrained in us and in our culture. A lot of times I'll be trying to play the guitar and I'll be thinking in my head about how it's not good enough. And I shouldn't even do it because then I'm going to be a girl that's not as good. And, you know, you don't want you're pretty good for a girl. So then there's more pressure to perform well, to be the best. And there are also studies that say that women will apply for a promotion only when they think that they're 100% qualified, and men will when they think they're 60% qualified. And maybe this is just a language thing, that we're using different language to talk about the same thing, but it's happening. And I haven't seen a study, but it sure seems like there are less women leaders leading bands. There's definitely less women leaders in the world. But it's a matter of action. And I hope that any woman who's listening to this, who's sitting in their living room playing guitar just like I do, who has the inclination to play for people, I hope that you'll do it and find the joy and the love that you can get out of that.
I've been speaking with Lindsay Lou of Lindsay Lou and the Flat Bellies. Their latest album, Ionia, will be released on Valentine's Day. For more information and to purchase the album, you can visit their website at lindsayloumusic.com. Lindsay Lou, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Today's Days Ed was directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, Annie Norris, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.